Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and I'm very proud, very happy to be a part of this program. If you have any questions about this program or any programs, please go online and check out the schedule. I've said it every week, and I'm sticking to it. I think it's proved to be true. I think this might be the best Tuesday evenings lineup in my, I think I said 17 years. I think that's about right, that I've been doing Tuesday evenings, so that's saying a lot. I know, 20 tours a year, 20 lectures a year, that's not bad. I also want to make a few announcements, if you don't mind. Remind everybody of our program, Sundays with the Modern, which is a tour program at 1 p.m. every Sunday, except for certain holidays. So again, check the schedule online. We are asking architects, artists, art scholars of all stripes to come and talk about the permanent collection, aspects of the architecture, or the special exhibition. So this Sunday, Eric Swenson, who of course is an artist with work in our collection, but he's also an artist who was at UNT during Vernon Fisher's tenure, so it should be pretty interesting. He's going to come and talk about Vernon Fisher Kmart Conceptualism, which opened last Saturday but officially opens this Sunday. So come and hear that if you can. I also want to mention the ongoing graduate student gallery presentations that happen each Tuesday at 6:15 before the lecture. They're 30 minutes long, and then they also happen on Saturday. So if you should miss one, I think every student is repeating. And again, I invite you to go online to check out the schedule for that. We're so glad to have the cafe back. This is kind of an unofficial opening tonight, but it will be open now every Tuesday as it has been in the past. I encourage you to come early for the lectures. Get your ticket so you're assured a seat. And then the galleries are open until 7, as is the cafe. Next Tuesday, we have architect William Bruder here. He's here to jury the Fort Worth AIA competition, and he will share his ideas and work in that evening's presentation, Making Architecture in Celebration of People and Places. So I invite you back next Tuesday. And then the following week, I just want to jump ahead and remind you that the artist Lawrence Wiener will be here. I have to say I'm particularly excited about that one. And I believe that Michael Opping is making special arrangements to be sure his piece is in the gallery, so I invite you to go into the galleries that week and find Lawrence's piece that has been in the past in the cafe. Tonight we are so fortunate to have art writer and curator Michelle White here to speak on the early work of artist Via Selmans. Michelle received her MA in art history from Tufts University, and she has held curatorial positions at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, the Fogg Art Museum at Harvard University, and she comes to us tonight from Houston, where she is the associate curator at the Menil Collection, where she has organized exhibitions such as Lessons from Below, Otabenga Jones and Associates, Imaginary Spaces, Leaps into the Void, Documents of Nouveau Realist Performance, and Cy Twombly, Treaty on the Veil, which was co-curated by Bernice Rose for the Menil Drawing Institute and Study Center. And Michelle is currently in the midst of preparing for the installation of Via Selmans' Television and Disaster, 1964 to 1968, which she co-curated with Franklin Sermons, and which opens November 19th at the Menil before traveling to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. In addition, she is currently working on Richard Serra Drawing in Retrospect, which opens at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York in 2011, travels to SF MoMA, and completes its tour at the Menil in 2012. So I have to say that I'm a little surprised that I was able to convince Michelle to come here and do this tonight in the midst of everything that she has going on. But it seems quite obvious that Michelle is not afraid of staying busy. In her somewhat short career, she has become a significant force in Texas and beyond as a frequent contributor to art papers, a regional editor of Art Lies, a lecturer of contemporary art at the Glissell School of Art in Houston, and a member of the board of directors of the Lawndale Art Center. She has many publications to her credit, including catalogs for each of the exhibitions that I've mentioned, and numerous articles. Based on all that I have read, which has been much, I have to say, especially in Art Papers and Art Lies, Michelle is a gifted writer and a passionate and informed perspective that she fearlessly and I think quite thoughtfully defends. And tonight we have the pleasure of learning more about the work of one of the modern's beloved artists from just such a perspective in Michelle's presentation via Selman's in the 1960s. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Michelle White.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here. I'm honored to be a part of this series. So I'll get right into it. Artist Via Selmans is perhaps best known for works like these. Detailed spiderwebs, meticulously crafted drawings, paintings, and prints of things like the rocky soil of the desert floor. And just a few minutes ago, we also added, let's see, this is another very typical work by Via Selmans, if you know her work. This is included, this is here at the Fort Worth Modern, and I don't know the year of it. Do you, Terry? So it's these types of works that she began to make in the 1960s, with surface textures and sometimes even a disorientating sense of space that make the work seem to spill out into infinity. And it's the type of work that she's continuing to make today. And I thought I would throw in this painting. Am I just not clicking it hard enough? This is one of her most recent works. I saw it in process in her studio this past spring, and it was included in an exhibition she just had in New York at Renee McKee Gallery, and it's one of her most recent. It's called Shell, and you can see it's a close-up image of this porous, beautiful texture of a seashell, and it's a shell that she found near her vacation home in Mexico. The topic of my talk tonight, however, is not about Via's well-known surfaces. Instead, it's about a more grisly period in Via's work. It's not as well-known, and it's a specific time period, in fact, between 1964 and 1966. And what I'm arguing is that it's this period, this short phase when Via Selmans was only in her late 20s, that really formed the conceptual grounding of her work to come. And it also serves as the exhibition that Terry mentioned that I'm organizing at the Manil Collection with Franklin Sermons at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And it all grew out of this idea that we were going to look at Selman's early work. And in researching and talking with the artist, we found that it was this time period that was fascinating and often overlooked within a larger conversation in art history. And I will, since the dates are up right now, the opening night is November 18th. It's a Thursday, and the public's welcome. Via's going to be in attendance. And also the next night, on the 19th, which is a Friday, I'll be doing a public conversation with Via. So please come if you'd like a trip to Houston. So it was during this period that she was making works like these. And she was exploring themes of death and disaster. So these are two works in the exhibition, which will only consist of about 18 paintings and sculptures. So you can see on the left, it's a man on fire running from the wreckage of a car. And on the right is forest fire. And the painting on the right actually has been in Via's studio since she believes it has never been shown, according to Via, but sometimes I'm not quite sure if she remembers, but we're thrilled to have it. It's just been restretched, and which, you know, it's the great thing about working with an artist. And she, too, hasn't really reflected that much on this specific time period, so it's been a treat to have these conversations and then to do this show. And so other works from this time period that I'll show involve other themes related to death and disasters. They include crashing airplanes, urban riots, and other images that she primarily derives from the mass media, from magazines, as well as images that she would covertly tear out of library books. This is how she explains it, that she couldn't buy the books, so she'd go to the public library and covertly tear them out. So what I'd like to argue, and the framework, the curatorial framework that we've established for this show, as well as the essay I've written for the catalog, and for which this talk is based, has to do with what makes this work from this time period, when the artist was only in her late 20s, so special and so unique. And in doing this research and talking to the artist, one of the most compelling reasons that we found has to do with what it means when we place V.S. Selman's work from this time period within a larger art historical conversation. Specifically, the historical, political, and geographical context that she was working in when she was making these works, and that was Los Angeles. And Los Angeles is where she initially moved to after she graduated from the Heron Art Institute in Indianapolis, and she came to Los Angeles in 1962 to attend graduate school at UCLA in painting. So when V.S. Selman's arrived to Los Angeles, this was a really unique moment and a really specific moment. That summer, when she lands in the city, Andy Warhol has just debuted his Silkscreen Soup Cans. It's in what has many consider Andy Warhol's first exhibition. And for many, this marks the significant shift away from the generation of abstract expressionist painters before her. And that was how she was trained as a young artist, in this abstract expressionist style. And it was among many events in this time, along with the Ferris Gallery show and Andy Warhol making his debut. There were other shows of artists like this featuring work where artists were turning to the real or common or everyday object to make comments about the banality of modern consumer society. And significantly, it was these artists, they weren't looking inside, like Jackson Pollock was looking inside to express himself. They were looking outside to the street itself. And it was a shift that was explored in an important exhibition that also came to Los Angeles the next summer. It was a show organized by the Guggenheim Museum, and it was called Six Painters and the Object. And it's yet another example of the heightened presence of pop art in the city at this time that was really seeping into the psyche of California artists. Included in that exhibition, for example, was Jasper John's Flag. And if anybody knows, I don't think it was this particular flag included in the show, but it's something I haven't been able to find. You know, as goes the well-known interpretation of this work, you know, while it's a representation or sign of a patriotic piece of cloth, through the artist's straightforward presentation, it also is a flag. That is to say, while it's not made of a piece of fabric per the object's traditional definition, Johns has rendered it in a way that the painting carries as much weight as the actual object, as the symbolic weight of the flag. And this is that brilliant collapse of the space between art and life. And it's this intentionally, we could say, confusing semantic dance between the sign and the signified that also emblematizes the type of elastic back and forth with the idea of representation itself that was informing Los Angeles art at the time and pop artists in Los Angeles as they were sort of negotiating what this language was meaning, especially as it was coming from New York City specifically. And they were invested in trying to figure out a way to make that language of pop art their own. And this is when V.S. Selman's is coming to age as a young artist. And it's in such this really fertile intellectual moment that the types of questions her early work is going to ask will bring forth this really complex relationship of form and content, which I believe really sort of forms the crux of her work and what really reveals the strength of V.S. Selman's as an artist, especially within the wider lens of painting in the 1960s. So to provide you a little bit more of a background in Los Angeles at the time, Artists, we could say, were influenced by a changing city of freeways, the movie industry, sunshine and sunsets. It was a look established and even given a title or referred to as the cool school. And that was a term defined in an essay by Philip Leader in Art Forum magazine in 1964. And in California, Leader wrote, artists such as Ed Ruscha, Larry Bell, Joe Good, were much like their New York counterparts, looking for a way to critique everyday life, advertising, consumer society, and doing so by adopting that slick language of the form itself of advertising and mass media. The California artists, however, Leader argued, were doing something different. They were responding with this cooler look that was subtler and less boisterous, and even more economical. California pop, Leader argued, was based on, quote, a hatred of the superfluous, a drive towards compression, and a precision of execution. Another example of this kind of understanding of the cool school aesthetic, especially that kind of precision of execution and that less boisterous feel, would be Joe Good's milk bottle paintings from the early 1960s. And this is one in the collection of the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego. And I like it because you'll see it very much seems to inform V.S. Selman's isolated objects that are about to come. And in these works, basically, he would take a regular Altadena dairy milk bottle, glass bottle, paint it, and set it in front on a shelf or on the floor in front of a muted monochrome canvas. And we can think about this in distinction to, say, Andy Warhol's soup cans or even his, soda bottles. With these, there's a certain sense, or there's a certain lack of irony, I'd say. It's less boisterous. This is this cool seclusion that Philip Leader was talking about in Art Forum magazine. So beginning in 1962, V.S. Selmans was also painting common objects, and she was painting them with that detached austerity and meticulousness of process that very much fit this cool school aesthetic. She was turning to these very functional and quotidian objects as opposed to decorative that she was seeing in her studio. So in addition to this hot plate, she was painting things like mugs of steaming coffee, frying eggs, coffee, portable electric fans. She would paint them life-size, and she'd place them on very muted muted backdrops of gray or beige. Okay, this is from my cell phone, so I apologize for the bad quality, but it actually looks pretty good. That's Via, and she doesn't know I took this picture. So this is in her studio. We were going through these boxes, and I like this picture because they're a reproduction of her previous paintings, these common object paintings, and she doesn't know where a lot of them are, and a lot of them have been lost, so it was kind of thrilling to see them in reproduction together. And if anybody knows, see, it looks like a kettle. She did these series of fish on plates around the same time, and does anybody know what, I cannot figure out what this is. Is it some type of radio? Does anybody know? Butter? Here? Really? What do you think those two little dots are? Interesting. Okay, a plate of butter. Thank you. So this gives you a sense of the other types of common object painting she was making around this time. And what's so interesting about these works, I think, is that she kind of makes them into this very hard-to-define emotional content. In many ways, they act like lonely statements of fact. For example, let's go to another work. This is also from the same time period. It's also an object that was in her studio that she painted life-size. And in fact, I should say in her master's show, which was in 1964 at UCLA, She actually made painted objects on canvas and put them on wood frames, so they became the actual objects in place. And none of them exist. She also would cut them out. She did a banana peel and cut it out and put it on the wall. So this painting is Heater. It's in the collection of the Whitney Museum of Art, and it was most recently exhibited this spring for the Whitney Collect show, if anybody saw it. So what it is basically a glowing portable appliance, and it sits firmly in the middle of the canvas. The cord extends to the left as if it's plugged in. And there's also, you can see kind of light modeling and shading evident at the base. Yet there's little else to indicate a discernible place. There's no clues to figure out where it is. We don't know where the heater's location could be. And that's this kind of hard-to-determine emotional content that I think is so interesting about this work. And moreover, in addition to this ambiguous backdrop, Selman's techniques, too, are based on these reductive, pragmatic decisions that seem to be about as utilitarian as the objects she's painting. And I think as a result of this, you know, the artist's very nuanced play with formal details, like this placeless palette, creates a really disconcerting atmosphere. And it seems to freeze, even that fiery center of the heater, as if it's wrapped in this chilly stillness. And interestingly, in the first published review of V.S. Selman's work from 1964, the reviewer said that, be careful, V.S.'s work will keep you at arm's length. So when V.S. Selman's moved to Los Angeles for graduate school, her ambition was to do just as the critic described. She wanted to purge the surface of her work and remove that diaristic subjectivity that had defined the action painting of artists like Jackson Pollock a generation before her. For her, art came to be about the cold, hard facts. And I'll quickly pause, since we're in V.S. Selman's move to Los Angeles in the 60s. The top image is of her studio. She had a studio on Venice Boulevard that she described as big and bright, and it's also where she lived. And it looks like there's one of the paintings of the plane in process right here. And the picture on the bottom is Via in the process of making the first painting that I showed of the Burning Man. And so going back to Via's sort of take on how she was thinking about process, she said at this time, quote, "I decided to go back to looking at something outside of myself. I was going back to what I thought was this basic, stupid painting. There's the surface. There's me. There's my hand. There's my eye. I paint. I don't embellish anymore. I don't compose. I don't jazz up the color." So really avoiding any thought of contrived composition, Selman's was approaching her work with a sober restraint that was consciously modest. She was rejecting, again, that bombastic and subjective way of making that had defined the generation of artists before her. And in fact, when I asked the artists, and something I've always been intrigued by her work is how she explains her method of applying the paint. And she told me even the way in which she first chose to apply the paint, and I should mention the way she begins painting in the 1960s is what defines the way she's painting today, was about this desire to find a way to paint that resists the past. In fact, she tries not to even have a technique or she doesn't articulate it as having a technique, which is interesting. And she said to me, quote, "I try to paint softly, without making any gesture, without any theater, without making my stroke something that would be mine." And if we go back to the heater and think about this, it's this, what I found in thinking about this work is what's so fascinating then about this very cerebral, very cool approach to making is how art history has not positioned it within that conversation about the cool school. And in looking for explanations, it's interesting to me to find that It was Lucy Lepard who included Via Salmons in her very early chronicle of pop art in 1964, so right when Via is starting to make these works. She's included in this publication that really defines what pop art is about. And there was a chapter on California pop. And in this text, she very much suggests that Salmon's paintings from this time of aloof and menacing ordinary objects, with their hot coils, with their steam, with their electricity, are comforting, if not humorous. And I'll read the quote from the text because I think it's really fascinating. She writes, "Via Salmons does realistically describe portraits of isolated smoking objects, a just-fired pistol, steaming matzo balls and chicken soup, cooking eggs, and a selection of turned-on appliances. The isolation of objects against empty background makes for comedy. In this instance, rather than surrealist effects, most are warmly domestic pictures. And even the pistol has a fireside coziness about it." So this interpretation was so fascinating to me, and it prompts the question, right? Do Salmon's paintings truly convey this homey and even feminine sense of retreat? Or do they capture that cool, again, detached austerity that critics would have read in the work of her male colleagues at this time as a really smart allegory of painting itself in the state of representation in the 1960s? And that's the argument that essentially I'm trying to make. To be sure, Salmon's work does not categorically conform to the tenets of any movement. And she herself does not believe that her work kind of fits what she called this LA look. She was friends with a lot of California artists of the time. She was good friends with James Turrell, Douglas Wheeler, Robert Irwin. But she believed that what she was making was quite different and that she was isolated from her peers. Moreover, to think about Salmon's place in the larger history of art, it's also been undefined as a result of her emergence in this very transitional moment of art making, painting specifically. I mean, the decision to paint like this in such a representational style in this moment of time could very much seem anachronistic. And it's for this reason been easy for many writers to kind of situate her in this placeless category, instead of putting her within the conceptual significance of the conversations that were taking place at this time. One example is Dave Hickey, how he's understood Via Salmon's process or Via Salmon's work at this time. And he wrote that her work has, quote, a kind of stateless foreign accent. So what I'm arguing, again, is quite different. I think we really greatly diminish the power of her work if we remove it from this discourse, remove it from what else was happening at this time. For it's this context that's especially important to Salmon's paintings made between 1964 and 1966, especially those that are defined by more violent imagery. So in 1964, so she had started making these common object paintings in 1962, and in 1964, here's the shift. She begins by making these pistol paintings. And this is a whole series. There's about four paintings that exist of a hand holding a gun. And with these, she begins incorporating found images of violence from television and the media. And it's also, this shift has also been attributed to the way she changes the way of working. Instead of looking again at that real object, the real object sitting on the floor of her studio, she began to use her own snapshots and collected images that she pulls from magazines and clips from books. It's these tangible representations that you can hold in your hand. Oops. Okay. I just jumped the gun there. And she says that she likes to collect images that she can sort through like playing cards. And here's another one of my cell phone images. But what I loved is that she has these drawers in her studio, and they're just filled with images. And you can see, she has a stack of the star images. She also takes pictures of her work and thinks about them even more through this kind of these fragments that are almost like objects that she uses as inspiration. And here, I just I did a close-up of this one. This is Via, probably in the late 1960s. She didn't remember what date exactly, but this would have placed her in her late 20s, so around 64, 65. And that's her, too. So you can see this is a source image for the gun painting that she used to make the work. That was also in her piles of images in her studio. So of this series, basically it's a cropped forearm that emerges from one side of the canvas. And it's that fragment that I mentioned that's used as a source. And according to the artist, this is the story, that apparently a friend who was moving away gave her a gun. She didn't really know what to do with it. It was sitting on her floor, and much like those common objects when she was looking for inspiration around her, she decided to ask a friend to hold it so she could take a picture to base a new series of work on. And she said she was intrigued by the power of this thing. And here's another variation. This is in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art. So as in her previous work, Selmans has again made these reductive formal decisions. We have the same placeless background and that alluring cloak of this kind of pallid neutral hue. And again, the subject is rendered life-size, and she's applied the paint with that careful and soft but impersonal touch. But what's different here and what's different in this break from those common objects is how the form complicates the subject matter. And we could say because it's sort of kind of wrapped in that hushed haze of what's now become her characteristic mode of rendition, the difficult content does not immediately evoke what we might expect to see from an image of a gun. And it's kind of this formal play, and I think what it does is it makes you question the emotional tenor or even meaning of this image that looks so simple. And I think you can see that right away in the one detail that I love in these paintings is this kind of sfumato-like blur of the gun, of the sort of smoke, which would be the ignition of the gunpowder that forces the bullet out of the barrel. And it's a detail found in all of these. And I think what it does is it captures this action of violence, right? We know because of the smoke that the bullet has just left the gun, that someone has just pulled the trigger. But at the same time, she sort of blunted that aggressive motion by allowing that smoke just to hang. It's kind of like a lethargic cloud. It's that kind of hush of that stilly, like, sense of how she's applying paint and the color she's deciding to use and that centralized composition. And that's what Selmans has called the gentle quality of these gun paintings. So if we go back to the tentative state of painting, of representation itself in the 1960s, this gentleness is really the crux of Via's work. And I think it's what really puts that deeper conceptual swag into her sort of cool school involvement. It's the balance of really difficult subject matter, the content, and the way she's rendered it, or the form. And it's that kind of place, that place of ambiguity where I think notions of violence seem to stagnate in that liminal atmosphere, where meaning is really difficult to ascribe. You know, here are some questions, like what exactly should we think of a gun? What were the consequences of the action? Is this an indirect image of death or a playful representation that we might see in advertising or on a commercial? And here's another painting that's included in the exhibition that does something I think really similar to the guns. Because it's also situated, I think, in that equivocal space, that space of stillness, that place where meaning is really difficult to determine. So essentially, this is a painting, it's a representation of a representation. And like the gun paintings, there's this startling moment that has been frozen. So it's a plane falling in mid-air with debris, but it seems to stop. It stops right in the center of that screen. And again, there's another appliance painted life-size from her studio. But so here's the catch. This action, this moment of violence, is framed by the television. Yet the event in the foreground is not dramatically offset by what should be the light of the television screen. Rather, the gray image seems to bleed into the background. So the background and the foreground seem to have as much visual weight. So the blank gets as much attention as the scene of terror. And here's another painting from the exhibition that also has that sense of arresting emotional ambiguity. This is a painting of a cover of Time magazine. The date is August 20th, 1964. And the artist here is replicated with detailed fidelity this issue, which was released days after the Watts riots in Los Angeles. And in stacked images from the masthead, the magazine presented three images. So on the top is a block of burning buildings. The second register is an overturned car and this puddle of crushed glass. And on the bottom is this kind of urban scene of riots or looters. And of course, it's the event that took place for over 6 days in the Los Angeles neighborhood of South Central Los Angeles, when Villa would have been living in the city. So like the TV, if we go back to that as an example of, again, this discursive relationship between form and content, or the gentle painting technique and the really loaded subject matter, that's what makes it difficult to form a really clear reading of the work. And, you know, so we're faced with these contradictory clues. And again, it like leaves us to question, like, what's the meaning of the work? What's the intention of the artist? Is she making a comment about the media portrayals of violence? Or is she addressing mortality or talking about race in the United States? We're not quite sure. And I think that's the point. And as a example to compare, if we think of a comparable series from around the same time, so it would be Andy Warhol's series of silk screens of death and his Death and Disaster series. So this is of the same year, this is a year before, 1964. And this is a similar series, right? He's dealing with similar themes. If you know this work, he does images of capital punishment. In addition to the race riots, you have things like men jumping off buildings for suicide. And he, too, appropriates images or uses images from the mass media or photojournalism as inspiration. But here's what's different. We could say that Andy Warhol's making a clear statement. He's making a clear point about this kind of the ubiquity of violence in our everyday lives. And by emulating the silkscreen method, which is a form of commercial reproduction, he's making a comment about the ubiquity, about the boredom. He's making a clear critical statement. And Via Selman's is not. Okay. And the kind of next series she goes on to make is a series of planes. The one on the left is here at the Modern, and it's upstairs. Is it upstairs? Yeah. Downstairs in the galleries right now. And we're borrowing this work for the exhibition, which we're really excited about. So thank you. And this kind of strategy of ambiguity, of arresting ambiguity, is particularly effective in this work that she began to make in 1965. And it's of images from World War II and World War I of military airplanes, including things like bombers. And if anybody would like to identify the particular planes, shout them out, because it's not my area. And here...
One on the left. I believe was made by the company Junker, and it's a particular model bomber that was really outfitted as a kind of a VIP passenger plane, never really used in combat.
Oh, okay.
That happens to be true.
Do you know what the symbol is?
Well, that's the Second World War symbol of Germany.
Okay.
The cross.
Okay. Thank you. And speaking of World War II, I think this is a great time to mention Via's biography. Solmans was born in 1938, and she was born in Riga, Latvia. And she fled with her family when she was 10 years old in 1948 to Indiana. But it also would have meant that she was a child during very difficult times in Eastern Europe, during Red Army occupation, including also German occupation of Latvia in the 1940s. So she's also discussed these in terms of relating to her own biography at this time and her own sort of relationship of thinking about her history. And so after Via started introducing photographs and found images as source material for her work, she started making these paintings. And she said they were first inspired by those tiny plastic airplanes that you used to get in commercial flights that she loved to collect. And again, by the photographs about war that so captivated her, she would tear them from library books. And some of them are just gorgeous, and they just seem to very peacefully float in the air, such as these, especially the one from San Francisco over there on the right. It seems to just hover very gracefully over the horizon line. Some of her other planes, however, encounter more catastrophic situations. They tumble from the sky. They explode in flames, and like this one, crash into the sea. And Selmans had said that this series in particular came almost naturally through this intuitive method where she allows the image, not the idea, to come first. So this is what we dug up in our studio. This is the original source image for this plane. And you can see it's been pulled from some type of text or magazine. I couldn't figure it out. She didn't know either. So again, if somebody recognizes this, that would be wonderful. So it was only later, however, that she acknowledged that it was these works, this series with the planes in particular, that came out of the type of introspection that she said was a result of moving away from her family for the first time. She moves to Los Angeles, she moves into this new studio, and she starts thinking about her life. And she said it was then that she kind of first started to accept the weight of her past, the weight of her childhood, and the sense for the first time that she was having of cultural displacement. Additionally, at this time, what's so interesting about the overlap of her personal history with the larger political history of the United States when she was making these works about death and disaster was that she was at the same time outraged by the Vietnam War and participating in public protests. And I thought I would just throw this in, because if you're not familiar with this work, it's really fascinating. It's a project that was initiated by the sculptor Mark DeSouvreau in Los Angeles in 1965. And it was a project of the Artist Protest Committee, which is a collective or a group of artists that came together to protest the Vietnam War. And they did this project. It was up for 3 months. And Via Selmans was a participant in it. And you can see that around the base of this, I think it was 58-foot tetrahedron, what is the word? Someone wants to explain that shape, were paintings by artists, including Selmans, that were then sold, and funds were given to a particular charity or activist group. I'm not quite sure. But it's just fascinating that along with this anger about the political situation in the United States and her own personal introspection, she was making these images of warplanes. So in addition, while she was thinking about her past and her childhood, she was making this other series of work. This is a little bit later. This is not in the show. This is from 1967. But around this time, she starts exploring these really quotidian objects that would be in a school desk, like erasers. She also did pencils. And she made them quite large. So it would be 58 inches. And this is a three-dimensional object. If you know, too, she did that piece around this time of that giant comb that was 6 feet tall that's in the collection of the Los Angeles Museum of Art. So there's this great sense of whimsy and play with childhood that's also complemented by this very serious investigation of war. So the work that we're including in the exhibition is dealing with childhood, but also dealing with a little bit more severe themes to get to this point about her sort of situation in this moment of history. And so she started working on like the eraser. She would turn to these, like she made puzzles, she made objects like this, which it's tiny, it's about 4 inches, and it's that game where you would take the marbles and tilt them around until they fall into the indentions. And it's this really fragile, beautiful plexiglass sphere. And on the base, what she does is she's painted one of her now well-known images of a warplane crashing and with a trail of smoke. And again, that's this juxtaposition. This nostalgia is offset by this really kind of deep and almost horrific image. And this will be in the show. We're really pleased because it's been a really difficult piece to get. It's fragile, so the lender didn't want it to travel because he was afraid the marbles would hit the plexi in transit. And so we've developed a whole packaging system now just for this. So it's a great feat. You have to come see it. And so along with works like this, she was also started making these tiny houses, so very much like a dollhouse, but here you have a dollhouse that's engulfed in flames. This is from a private collection. It hasn't been shown in a while. And another great example is this piece from the Museum of Modern Arts. And so on this very cute sort of form that you might think of as a child, she's painted that hand-holding gun motif again. And also, which is great, if you think about the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, it's the reference to the Brett Oppenheim teacup here. And another example of this kind of startling duality of childhood and war is this piece, which may not initially seem like a good choice for the Death and Disaster exhibition we're doing, but this is a rhinoceros. It's in the collection of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and you can see it's this magnificent beast kind of floating in that field of foliage. And she describes this as, you know, we weren't even initially putting this in the show. We were looking at images of her work, and she said, we have to put this in. And for her, the rhinoceros is like an army tank. And she feels it bridges that thematic vacillation between the playfulness of childhood and the severity of war. And I think especially so because the work leads to so many readings and conflicting readings even. You know, on one hand, this work inspires very whimsical thoughts. For me, I've thought of things like animal crackers, zoos, National Geographic magazines. I thought about Albert Durer woodcuts. At the same time, it's really heavily an endangered body, rendered in Selman's very gentle but sober painting technique, elicits notions of danger and vulnerability. And so like her continued investigation of ambiguity via that interchange of form and content, the mismatch relationship of war and play is about blurring boundaries, creating juxtapositions that build that ambiguity so well. And so I'll end here, and really, again, making the case that the power of Selman's work from this time derives from that great interchange of form and content. That's the allegory of painting itself, and that smart take on the art historical dialogue of the time that we need to use to understand the politic of her work, and not that sort of placeless foreign accent, as Dave Hickey wrote. And it's that process that really elicits ambiguous emotions and even poetic readings from those hard, straight, and difficult images. Thank you. So are there any questions?
What do you think the advantage is of putting Solomon's in that same camp as the male artists that work at the same time? I mean, what does that do for the work now, in 2010?
Well, I think because still we often, like Dave Hickey said, understand Solomon's work in this ambiguous category, in this category that defies an art history. And I think that's been the fallacy of art history in terms of a feminist perspective, is leaving women artists out of the larger discourse as if they're doing something different. And while, formally, stylistically, yes, she was doing something quite different, as I'm hoping to argue, it's that same kind of like cerebral, slick, and cool aesthetic that she too was very much interested in. And that's the meat of understanding this work in terms of its greater significance to the time, and that conversation that was happening about representation and about painting. And I should also add, as a compliment to this show, I'm doing a small exhibition of work from our collection from California at this time, so John McCracken, Larry Bell, that I'm hoping can further this dialogue.
I think she has a piece in a show that's going to open the Brooklyn Museum called Subversive Pop, and it's women pop artists. Does she identify as being a pop artist?
Not really, just as she doesn't really identify as being an LA artist. She always, like, the way she talks about how she was working is that she wasn't a part of any dialogue. She wasn't a part of a movement. She wasn't a part of a school. But if we also think about the way she was positioning herself when she was talking about, when I said the quote about she wanted stupid painting, she wanted to paint without a technique. She too, part of her goal at this time was to remove herself from the past. And as a consequence, she was also, I think, trying to remove herself from that history or from what other people were doing at the time. So I don't know how she feels about that show, but it seems really appropriate, especially thinking about the house with the fur, which is a reference to Mariette Oppenheim, who is, of course, a subversive, surrealist artist. Yes?
If part of her strategy is to remove the mark of her hand, mm-hmm. and reacting against that kind of emotionality of the previous generation, then does it strike you as ironic that these things are so labor-intensive?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's like she has to work so hard to make it seem like there's no mark of her. Yeah, absolutely. But, I think if you do, I mentioned that's how she started painting, this non-technique in the 1960s. If you look at her more recent work, like The Starry Night that's in the collection here at the Modern, you can tell that there's much more of a belabored process, that she just does layers and layers and sands it. And so I think in her more recent work and work coming out of the 1970s, the labor-intensive process is a lot more pronounced.
Wouldn't that be in contrast, though, with the more impulsive, at least the way we understand abstract expressions paintings to be made, that the longer she works on it, the more she can remove herself emotionally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's a great way to think about it. There's nothing spontaneous about it, right? Like, it's thoughtful. It's time-consuming. It's almost just a task that she's carrying out. That's the stupid painting. It's not this kind of emotive gestures that's expressing her soul. Yeah. Yes.
Does she mention Magritte very often? I mean, because certain things that she does, I mean, there's surreal aspects of her work, especially the gun, where she sort of denied the fire. And mm-hmm. you don't see the fire, so it looks like the gun's angry because it's like steaming.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she loves Magritte. Well, her big combs, for example, have often been compared to René Magritte work. So there's the painting, the René Magritte painting, for example, with a big comb that she has sort of taken. But also the influence of Magritte, of course, we could call again that stupid painting. Magritte was not about the form. He was not about the sort of expression of gesture. He was just getting it down to make the representation. But yes, there's a great affinity to Magritte, and another reason why we're really thrilled to be doing this exhibition at the Manil.
I was really intrigued by the painting from 1964 of a hand holding a firing gun, because it was the only one I noticed that had the date 1964 in the lower right. I wonder, is that more than just a signifier of when it was done? Is it related to the content of it anyway?
Wait, was it? Oh, here, right here. You know what? I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't know. I'll ask her and find out. I didn't even think about it. Yes. Yeah.
I have a question about that rhinoceros painting, specifically because she really wanted it to be in the show. I think that it's interesting that all of these other death and disasters have a pretty tangible connection to the devastation of humanity, whereas this, I don't know if you spoke about it and I just missed it, but there's this kind of smoky fire behind, which is, to me, speaks very loudly about the devastation of nature,
yeah,
and the devastation of, you know, rhinoceroses and they're very hotly pursued for the corn and for this reason and that reason. Did she, you know, she obviously has this kind of subtext of social commentary about violence and war and death. But does she also have this subtext of conservation or?
Not that I'm aware of. And I think she, she doesn't have a strong message about the mortality of war, right, or death, or disaster. I mean, that's the kind of beauty of this, is she's almost like, she's not evading it. She's just using it to make these greater questions. So, no, she would never say something like, I love nature and want to protect it with this image or something. But I think for this one in particular, and this has been the